So you see a direct relationship, sort of a call and response relationship between like BLM protests and Donald Trump's election to the United States presidency.
I wouldn't say a one-to-one, right? I would say that it's definitely part of it, right? White supremacy and Republican politics and Democrat politics and Black politics don't all map onto each other easily, right? And I'm not saying that, like, you know, the Republican Party is inherently white supremacist or, you know, I'm not saying that at all. I'm actually saying the opposite, right? I'm saying that racial politics kind of spans across party lines, right? And it kind of manifests itself in different ways along party lines, right? And so what I would say is that you have a lot of people that saw the Black Lives Matter as kind of a moral panic or a threat to the social fabric of American society, whatever that means, right? And saw the Republican line of, you know, law and order that came through the primaries and so on and so forth as being a way of kind of mobilizing their feelings about Black Lives Matter and their concerns about Black Lives Matter.
It's interesting to note that in a couple of the instances of famous instances of civil rights advances, you know, the Reconstruction and mm-hmm. and integration, mm-hmm. Have involved presence of federal troops enforcing.
Yes.
So what do you think is or should be the role of the federal government in the present day?
Yeah, sure. That's a great question. I think that that's a spot on analysis. And I think that that's another way of like race and racial politics kind of not mapping neatly onto political institutions. Right. Because if you look at the Southern strategy, but also the opposition to Reconstruction, the kind of political legal basis for this opposition comes from the idea of states' rights. Right. And the kind of federalist, right, kind of analysis of what it means to have the federal government be the insurer of civil rights for Black people, right? And the second half of your question was, what do I think the role of the federal government is? I think that in particular, I'll put it like this. I genuinely believe that if you leave decisions over civil rights up to the states, some states will do fine and others will take advantage. I think the Supreme Court ruling over the gerrymandering in North Carolina, I believe it was, that happened last week, right, is a good example of you could have states and state legislators that may genuinely not hold a, you know, racist bone, any sort of opinion towards anybody else, but will enact institutional racism in order to secure their political future, right? And that's to say that I don't think that you have now, again, I keep on saying now, like it's not going to change. You may have, but in the 50s with George Wallace, right, with Goldwater, right, you have these kinds of explicit opposition to civil rights movement, the civil rights movement that formed the basis of their political platforms. I think for the most part now, you still can't do that, right? Even though we're pushing it. And so that's to say that I don't think that, you know, you have to have the federal government kind of in the past where you had the federal government kind of standing off and, you know, troops being sent in by the federal government to ensure the civil rights of Black people against racist, like explicitly racist governors, right, and legislators, right? Instead, now it's more of the federal government has to kind of hedge and can hedge, but also can enact kind of against and along with more colorblind racism, right, or institutional racism, or outcomes made by candidates that ultimately have racial consequences.
Right. So, yeah, let's get into a little bit more into those subtler kinds of racism.
Sure.
There are plenty of people who voted for Trump,
yep,
or who vote for other, you know, similar but less spectacular politicians, mm-hmm, who wouldn't identify themselves as having a strong opinion one way or the other about Black Lives Matter.
Yeah.
And yet they're doing this thing which is, like, in its effect, like, racist. And so can you talk about that?
Yeah, sure. And I think this is kind of where how do I say this? In a weird way, I don't want to say sympathetic. I'm not going to say that. In a weird way, I am understanding of a lot of people who voted for Trump and are frustrated by being called racist. And I think I say that because I think that there's different ways of understanding racism, and I think that those ways kind of end up meshed along party lines, right? So I think that you have a lot of liberal, lefty, Democrat people that are understanding racism as kind of an institutional thing, a social thing, a systemic thing, so on and so forth, as well as an individual thing. Whereas on the other hand, you have people who understand racism as a strictly individual kind of hate crime, racial slur kind of politics, right? Which is, that can be racist, but that's kind of the only framing of racism that folks have, this kind of neoliberal individualist based on racism. I can evaluate racism through the way that you interact with other individuals who are of a different color than you. I can evaluate your sexism based on the way that you interact with other individuals who are of a different gender than you, right? Or different sex than you, right? And so I think that you have a lot of people that, and this is actually a criticism of people, I guess, on the left that try to understand Trump voters, is that they assume that the kind of political motivating factor for somebody to vote for Trump is racism, right? Or the kind of way that, Trump voters justify their decision or, and it's like, no, not necessarily, right? Of course you have the alt-right, you have the Bannons, you have the Richard Spencers, like, yeah, out in droves, we saw them in Charlottesville, right? Sure, right? Those people are racist, and it's obvious so, and they will do their politics based on racism. But you have a lot of people that have no kind of ill will towards any people of any other race, but it's in their economic interest to vote for Trump, or it's in their religious interest to vote for Trump, right? Things like this, right? And so I think it's super important to kind of this is called voter heuristic, right? This is the idea is that different voters have different thresholds for what they will vote for a candidate for, right? And so it's important that to remember that just because you have a block of voters that all vote for the same candidate, they don't all have the same heuristic, right? They don't all have the same motivation for voting for Trump. And so when you look at it kind of across the political divide, right, across the party lines, right, it looks like that because Trump and because, his policies, be it on immigration, right, be it his appointment of Jeff Sessions and policies on policing and things like that are pretty much classic instances of institutional racism, that doesn't mean that the people who voted for him want institutional racism to occur, right? And that's the tricky part, is conversing across those lines.
So do you think it's irresponsible to use the term racist in reference to those people?
I think overall, yes. I think that if you say that somebody who voted for Trump is inherently racist, I think that you do a tremendous disservice to how people vote and how people make political decisions. I think that, it's important to... Words have meaning, right? And right. Just kind of throw them out whenever you want, right? And just to kind of use like one kind of analysis, one instance of voting for Trump to label somebody as racist is really dangerous. And I also think it does a disservice to how racism can take different forms. So you also have people that might vote for Democrats over explicitly racist issues, right? And this is to say that like to kind of, draw a, capital T truth over the course of history that Republicans are the only party that can do racism and the only party that attracts racists is just not true. And also really, underestimation of how racism works.
Right. Yeah. I think it can be a bit of a cognitive dissonance for people to think of someone like Hillary Clinton as being contributing to racism, or thinking of like you said earlier, just day-to-day actions or that aren't ostensibly racist as being contributory. And I've definitely been guilty myself of that kind of oversimplification. Mm-hmm. It's hard not to fall into that sometimes.
I don't know. So, your reader, your listeners might not know this, but I'm from Georgia. I lived there for the first 18 years of my life, very much Republican, even though it's changing now. But this is to say that this isn't like the I have black friends example, right? But it's to say that I've lived in a city in a town that is full of Republicans, and you have a lot of really well-meaning people that are Republican, and they genuinely believe that, like, less government regulation, free market economics, like, is the best way to kind of help minorities. Mm-hmm. And that's I disagree, but that's not to say that they are voting Republican because they're racist. Is actually, they probably genuinely think that they're not racist, right? And so to kind of just show up and call those people racist is like, I don't think I would do that. I think that there's something, a higher level of a conversation that we need to have here about political ideology. And those are great people to have that with. But I think that, you know, when you just kind of assume a priori kind of from the start that they are racist because they're Republican or because they voted Republican, it's just not good.
Yeah. So what do you think? How do you personally bridge that? I mean, when you were living there, when you encounter people like that, or how do you suggest?
You know, that's kind of a weird thing for me because I left when I was 18, and I haven't really lived in the South for an extended period of time since, especially since I've become involved in Black activism and things like that. And I think that, you know, I think that you have to have good evidence, right? And this is also a whole different discussion on how to persuade people and, you know, but you have to have good evidence, right? And you have to, it takes a long time, right? This is not something, you know, political discussions are not something that happen, you know, and are successful over like Facebook meme wars or something, right? It's like, you know, this takes a long time. And you have a lot of people that I have several friends that were Republican and really fell out of love with that specifically because of Black Lives Matter. And they saw the discussions that what their friends were saying versus what, you know, people on the ground were saying versus what their friends who are minorities are saying. And there's, you know, it just kind of that ideology that they had clung to just kind of fell apart over time. And I think that that's what you really have to kind of do is say, you know, if I can talk with you and convince you to, you know, buy this one aspect of institutional racism, if I can talk to you and convince you to, you know, really be maybe skeptical of this aspect of neoliberal economics, right? Or something like that, right? Not saying I have to make you into a full-blown communist, right? It's just like, hey, you know, maybe the assumptions, and this goes for, you know, any kind of political ideology, like being able to say, hey, maybe the assumptions that you had don't really hold up under scrutiny like you think they do. And I think that those are the kind of, you know, best ways to engage with people, because you have a lot of people that if you engage with them, you have a lot of people that don't, right? I'm not going to be up here. I'm never the person that's here to say that everybody's like a quote unquote rational decision maker or quote unquote open to persuasion. But you have people that, you know, they will kind of change their opinion if you sit down and hold their hand and walk them through kind of the stuff that they think and, you know, present counterexamples. You know, I have friends that constantly don't know about the Southern Strategy, you know, friends that constantly don't know about the party realignment in the Americas. So they swear that like Republicans are the anti-racist group. It's like, that's not how that worked. And so you kind of have to sit down and say, here's what happened. Here's how the parties change sides on racial issues, right? Oh, here's what happened, right? Here's how the Klan blew up half of Black Birmingham, right? Yes, these things happened. These things happened when your parents were alive, right? And then, you know, if you show them the examples, they kind of start to chip away at those really strongly held beliefs.
I think we're moving toward a great place to close this.
Sure.
But is there any other thoughts you have or things you want to add?
No, I mean, this is really, I really enjoy the conversation. I think that, you know, I just kind of hope that your listeners, you know, maybe I have some stuff that, some books that they can check out or some examples to kind of hop on more. Did you want me to do that now?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, so definitely check out the Equal Justice Initiative report. I would say that your listeners should also, and I kind of wish we had touched more on this, of the role of internationalism. So a lot of Black power politics, Black separatist ideas actually come from Black people, not from the Americas, right? You have a strain of that in the Americas, but you also have a lot of, you know, people coming from other parts of the Caribbean dealing with slavery and aspects of slavery outside of the Americas that fundamentally influence American politics, too. So definitely check out if your listeners don't know, definitely check out Marcus Garvey and the United Negro Improvement Association. Definitely a good way to understand kind of early Black nationalists in the United States. And then also A New Day in Babylon is a great book on Black power politics by William Van de Berg. Definitely worth checking out. And, you know, we talked about a lot, but there's a lot that wasn't here. So if you're interested in more of that stuff, you know, should I throw out my Twitter handle?
Yeah, do it.
Throw out my Twitter handle. Yeah, so I have a Twitter that I use to communicate occasionally. If people want to like talk to me or continue the discussion, I love talking with people about these things. you know, it's been a really good opportunity to talk with you all here at the Sanctuary. But my Twitter handle is Weddington Soch, and that's WED as in dog, D as in dog, ING, T as in tango, ON, and SOC. And if they want to like tweet at me or follow me or inbox me, I would love to continue the conversation. I'm sure I'll be back on here more.
I hope so.
I mean, we can talk, of course, there's a lot of stuff we didn't talk about. We can talk about, but I really appreciate it. And I definitely, hope your listeners, take what we said to heart and kind of follow up on it on their own.
Cool. Well, thank you so much for being here. It's wonderful.
Thank you for having me.